All right, guys, I'm gonna get started just because I got a lot of content and I don't know what kind of time I'm gonna get through. But thanks for joining me at the prime time 8 a.m. Saturday morning slot. This is where they slot in all the prime speakers. I'm Teddy Arnold. I'm a lifelong Orioles fan. I live a few blocks away. Grew up in Baltimore, lived here my whole life. The only mildly interesting facts about me, I was at the last game at Memorial Stadium, and I was at the first game at Camden Yards, and I've watched the 89 Why Not video probably more times than anyone. Today I'm going to talk about which is home to the old Baltimore Orioles, 1891-99. I'm going to do a bit of a preamble as to how the O's ended up there before they got there. So baseball in Baltimore begins 1855. But the old Baltimore Orioles didn't come into existence until 1882, charter member of the American Association. They're known as the Lord Baltimores. They played their games at Newington Park, was located in West Baltimore. At the end of that season, the Orioles, as they became to be known, moved into a new ballpark known as Oriole Park 1, also known as Huntington Avenue Grounds, American Association Park. It was located at what is now East 25th Street and Greenmount Avenue. And in the six seasons there, they would finish last three times and rise no higher than third. Team owner and beer magnate Harry Vonderhorst relocated the team for a third time at the start of the 1889 season to what's known as Oriole Park 2, four blocks north of Oriole Park 1, located at Greenmount Avenue between what is now 28th and 29th Streets. Not a lot changed that season, though the team did finish with a rare winning record. And here's what I believe is the only known photograph of Oriole Park 2, the stadium in the background, the team photo featuring the likes of Matt Kilroy, the single-season strikeout record holder with 513 in 1885, among others. The struggling Orioles briefly dropped down to the short-lived minor league Atlantic Association for the 1890 season. However, halfway through, their American Association replacement franchise, the Brooklyn Gladiators, folded, and the Orioles rejoined the American Association in August, playing out the role of the defunct Gladiators. The Orioles began the 1891 season playing in Oriole Park 2, playing their first 23 games based there. However, shortly after opening day, it was announced that team owner Harry Vonderhorst is moving the Orioles across the street to Huntington Avenue so its games would be within easier reach of the people. The new grounds were going to be known as Union Park, or alternatively, Oriole Park 3. A double-decker grandstand extended behind home plate on the first baseline. A single deck down the third baseline seated an additional 3,000 with 14 rows of orchestra chairs. Western end of the stands was reserved for the ladies and their escorts, and more seats were going to be added. The distance from home plate to center field was 300 feet, and there were 16-foot-high wooden fences erected in the outfield. The field sloped down from east to west. It contained a mound, several trees, and a stream bed known as Brady's Run, which created a perpetual swamp in right field oozing under the outfield fence. And then a space at the northwest end of the grounds of about 250 square feet was set up with tennis courts and tracks for amateur sports, including baseball, lacrosse, and football. It was said that the cost of the grounds was $7,500, and at the time it was built, it was the largest ballpark in the American Association and the first in Baltimore to have a double-decked grandstand. Not only did Vonderhorst see the new grounds as a new way to boost attendance, he also saw another venue in which to sell beer. As owner of the Eagle Brewery and Malt Works, which had been started by his father, John H. Vonderhorst, of Swedish-German descent, Harry had been selling beer at Orioles games since he purchased the team back in 1882. Thus, the ballpark contained a beer garden and a restaurant, and business must have been good, prompting his famous quote of, "Well, we don't win many baseball games, but we do sell lots of beer." How Union Park got its name is a bit up for debate. Historian James Brady notes that for 30 years, fans had ridden in cars pulled by horses, and in the 1890s, the overhead wire electrical method was introduced. And by June 1891, three passenger railway companies had consolidated into what was known as the Baltimore Union Passenger Railway Company, which actually operated the first commercial electric street railway in the country in 1885. Brady suggests that as a business promotion, Union Passenger may have paid some of the new ballpark's construction costs. Another explanation may be that a company known as the Union Park Association, who had formed by its president, Major J.G. Pangborn, had several years earlier secured a lease on what was known as the Sadler property, located to the west of Pompeian Park. And the Baltimore Baseball Club, which was was Vonderhorst's company, had secured the lease from the Union Park Association to build the grounds, and perhaps that's how the name stuck out of familiarity. The opening day At Union Park, or perhaps the reopening day of the 1891 season, was May 11, 1891, against the St. Louis Browns for a four-game series. Admission was 25 cents. The inaugural game, the Orioles managed a crowd of 4,300 people to the new grounds. They retreated to former Oriole great Bobby Matthews in the capacity as an umpire. Orioles prevailed over the Browns by a score of 8-4, went on to split the series, but not before drawing a reported attendance of 24,000 over the four-game series. Praise for the new park was resounding, especially among the baseball brass. Manager Jack Chapman of Louisville declared they were among the best in the association. Charlie Comiskey, manager of St. Louis, stated that any man who can't play ball on the Baltimore grounds can't play anywhere. By season's end, the Orioles had managed a winning record while finishing third. And in December of 1891, of course, the American Association dissolved, and the Orioles were one of the four teams that joined the National League to form the 12-team circuit. The start of the 1892 season did not go as planned. Billy Barney had been ousted at the end of the prior season, replaced with George Van Hultren. With Van Hultren at the helm, the Orioles lost 10 of their first 11 games, which resulted in him being ousted, replaced with team vice president John Waltz. The move did not prove any better, as the Orioles lost 6 of their next 8 games under Waltz's watch. Recognizing the need for a, quote, baseball man to lead the team, Waltz recommended he be replaced. And on May 10, the Orioles' fortunes finally changed with the hiring of Ned Hanlon. Although the hiring of Hanlon no doubt breathed life into the organization, the Orioles went on to finish 1892 in dead last, with a record of 46-101. The only highlight of the season perhaps came on June 10, during a 25-4 rout of St. Louis. Wilbert Robertson went 7-7, a major league record, which is since tied by Rennie Stennett of the Pirates in 1975. Things did improve in 1893. The Orioles won 14 more games from the prior season, finished in eighth place with a 60-70 record. The 1894 season would prove to be the start of something special for the Orioles. That in no small part began with the hiring of new heads groundkeeper Thomas Murphy of the famed groundskeeping Murphy brothers, shown here in the middle, along with his brother Jack. With 10 years of groundskeeping experience under his belt, Murphy no doubt knew what improvements were needed at Union Park. He assured Hanlon he'd have the field as level as a billiard table by the time the Orioles returned from their spring training trip through the South. Murphy proceeded to make changes to the diamond that resulted in the greatest offensive weapon for the Orioles, which would favor their brand of inside baseball. The advantages of Murphy's work are detailed in Peter Morris's Level Playing Fields. This is the cover of that book, which I highly recommend, which describes how the infield soil is mixed with clay and water, and when rolled, because it's hard as concrete. And the concrete-like substance was placed in front of home plate and gave way to the invention, of course, of the Baltimore chop, which players hit down on the ball so sharply so they could make it to first base before a fielder could make a play. The rest of the diamond was anything but a billiard table. First base line was given a slight downgrade from home plate in order to assist players' running efforts. First to second was given the same treatment. Murphy built up the base paths from second to third with an uphill grade, and from third to home had a downhill grade to assist runners, but also the element of being built up from the outside to prevent bunted balls from rolling foul. The outfield was kept intentionally uneven, most notably the hill in right field where Willie Keeler roamed. It was noted to be a terror for visiting players. The grass was always kept ragged, full of weeds, which enabled Keeler to successfully perform his hidden ball trick. Apparently due to his familiarity with the rough terrain, he kept a stash of extra balls hidden in the weeds. When a visiting team hit a ball into the tall weeds, Keeler always managed to locate the ball, and for some reason balls hit by Oriole batters were not as easily located. A similar ploy was used on the pitching mound in the era before rosin bags. Pitchers would customarily pick up dirt around the mound to rub the ball down. Murphy would therefore sprinkle soap flakes near the rubber, which would end up in the hands of the unassuming visiting pitchers. And the Oriole pitchers, of course, knew where the locations of the soap were going to be. Sports writer Hugh Fullerton claimed the totality of Murphy's work at Union Park created the most unfair grounds ever constructed. Maintaining the grounds adapted perfectly to the home team's style of play and did more to win pennants than anything else. On opening day, the Orioles drew a crowd of 15,000, reported as the highest in the league, and one of the highest ever for a Baltimore baseball game. The balcony of the grandstand was not yet complete. Orange and black bunting had been strung along the upper tier, and a line of flags connected to the poles overhead. The Orioles beat the Giants 8-3. And while the improved grounds were likely a factor, the credit for the large crowd was attributed to improved transportation to the park in the form of electric streetcars, which have recently supplanted the old horse-drawn cars. Uh, 1894 would see the Orioles claim their first place in the National League pennant. Contributing factor to the Orioles' explosive offense was the team's penchant for triples. Late in the season in September, in a doubleheader against Cleveland, they hammered out 9 triples, which is a record that still stands today. In that afternoon, or in the same game, left fielder Joe Kelly went 9 for 9, scoring 7 runs, also setting a record which still stands. In 1894, Orioles still hold the record for the most triples in a season with 153. As a bonus for winning the pennant, the Orioles earned a trip to the Temple Cup, one of baseball's first attempts at postseason 4-game series between the first and second place teams. Despite the hype, the magic never set in, and they were swept by the New York Giants. Baseball wasn't Hamlin's only interest. In a scheme to fill the winter void, owners of the 5 baseball clubs, or 6 baseball clubs in the National League, formed the first professional soccer league in the country in August of 1894, known as the American League of Professional Football. And the league would feature teams in cities from Baltimore, Boston, Brooklyn, New York, and D.C. Hamlin managed the Baltimore club and, as I note here, would later be investigated by the Department of Treasury for signing a former English professionals and claiming they were American in violation of immigration laws. Thus, the first ever professional soccer game took place in Baltimore at Union Park on October 15, 1894, with Baltimore defeating Washington 5-1. The league did fold after its first season, citing mismanagement and low attendance. Turning back to baseball, Orioles management erected a small cottage inside Union Park to the left of the ticket office, which was occupied by groundskeeper Murphy. Having him live there was a good decision because on the night of June 14, a fire destroyed the grandstand and the clubhouse at Union Park. Once Vonderhorst had worked through the rebuild, the new grandstand was in the works. Work began in March on what was described as the best Baltimore had ever seen. The new stadium, as seen here, was arranged in a parabolic curve, which gave every seat a full view of the entire field. The first level would seat 5,000 people, the upper deck 1,500 reserved seats. The stand was 310 feet long, 365 in the rear, with a depth of 36 feet. And the champion pennant would fly from a pole rising 37 feet higher than the grandstand. It would be flanked on either side by similar poles flying the American flag. And the Orioles' winning ways continued in 95, with the team claiming a second straight pennant, but another Temple Club Cup loss to Cleveland. 1896 was, of course, the pinnacle year for the Orioles. Saw them win 90 games for the first time, get a third straight pennant. It was noted every team in the league was profitable that year. Baltimore was slightly less profitable than other teams, due in part to their 25-cent price of admission, where most teams charge 50 cents. On September 3rd, 1894, to make up for rainouts, a tripleheader was scheduled against Louisville, and then a doubleheader the following day. The tripleheader was one of only 3 tripleheaders in baseball history. The Orioles finally broke through with their third straight Temple Cup series, beating the Cleveland Spiders in 4 straight games and taking down the great Cy Young 2 times. Having finally captured both the pennant and the Temple Cup in the same season, they were primed to dominate 1897. Although the race came down to a thrilling finish between the Orioles and the Bean Eaters, and September saw huge crowds flooding the gates of Union Park, including the famous Royal Rooters led by Congressman Fitzgerald to support Boston. Paid admission on September 27th was 18,000, which was reported to be a record for Union Park. Unfortunately, the Orioles lost the 3-game series and ultimately the pennant to the Bean Eaters that year. Note that one of my favorite statistics occurred in 1897, which is when Willie Keeler recorded 239 hits and 0 home runs, which is pretty impressive. 1898 was a positive start to the season. The Orioles were victorious the first 3 games, but public interest had waned. Opening day attendance had fallen, and after going 6-2 in April, the team leveled off in May, winning only 50% of their games. A few bright spots in 1898 included 2 separate 12-game winning streaks, one of them entirely at Union Park. And despite winning 96 games, the Orioles were outmatched by Boston, who took the pennant that year with 102 wins. It was reported that year the total attendance was 123,000, less than half of what it had been during the first place years. And the Spanish-American War had certainly taken its toll on attendance throughout the league. And for the Orioles, the third year in a row, they had failed to turn a profit. To make matters worse, groundskeeper Tom Murphy had resigned and joined the Reds to be their groundskeeper in Cincinnati. And to cut his losses, Vanderhorst had acquired a controlling interest in the Brooklyn Trolley Dodgers and moved the star Orioles to the Brooklyn team, which included Keeler, Joe Kelly, and Huey Jennings. Of course, refusing to go were John McGraw and Wilbur Robertson, who saw business booming at their own venture, the Diamond Cafe. And after plucking a majority of the talent from the Orioles roster, Hanlon had named McGraw as the player manager. In exchange, the Orioles received four players who batted below 300 and three pitchers who would want to combine four career games, although one of them was Joe McGinnity, a future Hall of Famer. By all accounts, the Orioles exceeded expectations in 99. By mid-May, Hanlon had dubbed them the surprise of the season. On July 4th, history was made once again at Union Park when John McGraw became the first player to steal second, third, and home in the same inning. October 10 was the final home game of the season against Washington, the final professional baseball game ever to be played at Union Park, and the game ended in a 5-5 tie. By season's end, the McGraw-led, quote, leftovers, as dubbed by Bert Solomon, finished with an 86-61 record, good for fourth place, but 15 games back from Brooklyn. A terrific accomplishment for a team that had been decimated, not to mention McGraw, and during the death of his 22-year-old wife, Minnie, from a burst appendix that year. And, of course, following that season, the National League contracted to eight teams, causing Baltimore to fold its franchise. Although the official announcement of the league contraction would not occur until March, a movement had immediately begun following the end of the season to revive the defunct American Association. And looking to capitalize on National League cast-offs and growing resentment among players, the effort attracted Cap Anson and John McGraw to lead the charge. Having learned that Hanlon and Vanderhorst had inadvertently allowed their lease on Union Park to lapse in early January, McGraw swooped in and secured the rights to the grounds on January 25th in the name of the Baltimore Amusement Company. The lease included the land, stands, clubhouse, other improvements that had actually been paid for by Vanderhorst's Baltimore Exhibition Company. And then a legal battle ensued in which McGraw's company got an injunction against Vanderhorst's company from removing anything from the park. And then on the same day the injunction was issued, Hanlon and his company put up armed guards at the gates of Union Park, nailing no trespassing signs. When McGraw's forces attempted to gain access to the grounds, they were stopped by Hanlon's men. Some of them scaled the fence, jumped down onto the roof of Tom Murphy's old cottage, and a fight broke out. Police finally broke it up. McGraw's men had been carrying guns and clubs. They ultimately set up camp at third base. And on the other side of the diamond, Hanlon's men set up shop at first base. And a single police officer took his post in the middle or in the front of the ticket office. And this ridiculous scene would remain for much of the month while the battle in the courts continued. It wasn't long until the ground beneath the upstart American Association began to crumble. McGraw voiced his intention to continue his legal battle over rights to Union Park despite the lost season, but the reality had set in, and eventually a monetary settlement was struck with Hanlon and Vanderhorst. And then in early March 1900, the NL announced that Baltimore had exited officially from the circuit. With the lack of a pro team, Union Park would be home to games of the Minor League Atlantic Association. Okay. Although Baltimore had gone the entire 1900 season without a pro team, that was about to change. McGraw and Robertson landed the Baltimore franchise in Ben Johnson's new American League. McGraw was unwilling to consider Union Park unless the lease terms were renegotiated. And by early January, McGraw had signed a five-year lease for the land upon which American League Park was to be built, three blocks north of Union Park. What was to become of the old Union Park? Hanlon had still the leaseholder hoped to revive an American association to compete with the American League. Recognizing Union Park was still prime real estate, Hanlon hoped the grounds would be of use in attracting a franchise to Baltimore, but that effort ultimately failed. Despite the fact that Union Park was still in use by college and local teams, it was reported in 1902 the grounds would be cut up into building lots following the expiration of its lease in March 1903. Although still under lease by the NL through Vanderhorst Exhibition Company, who were on the hook for the final year's rents, speculation was that the NL was going to allow the lease to lapse. And with the erection of the American League Park, now the National League, who had secured the site to prevent the American League from getting it, had no further use for the old ballpark. After the AL and NL signed a peace agreement after 1902 to end the war over the players, Johnson ultimately managed to find a buyer in New York for the Baltimore franchise. And the few remaining Orioles were moved to the new team, which of course one day becomes the Yankees, Although it was said for 100 years the Yankees were descendants of the Orioles, baseball historical outlets made the move in 2014 to disassociate the two teams as not being connected, much to the chagrin of many. Not only did Baltimore lose the Orioles again, the newly constructed American League Park was placed into receivership, stands in the buildings would be auctioned off. Hanlon was still vocal at this point about his opinion that the National League would benefit from a team in Baltimore, and that Union Park would be a suitable grounds, even better than the American League Park. Although his hopes were high, any hopes of playing at the old park were dashed when the NL did officially decide to let the lease lapse in February 1903. And to make matters worse, they appointed Hanlon to essentially sell the old stands, lumber, and all the movable property belonging to the old club. Hanlon did finally manage to bring baseball back to Baltimore, albeit in the form of an Eastern League franchise that would eventually morph into the International League and feature, of course, Babe Ruth. And the new home of that team was going to be American League Park, which Hanlon actually purchased out of receivership for $3,000. It's unclear when Union Park was officially torn down, but it was purchased, the vacant lot was purchased in 1905, and it was turned into housing. So I'll just end here. The Orioles, the success playing at Union Park was frankly remarkable. 599 games, they had a record of 413 wins and 186 losses, with a win rate of 0.68. And from what I could find, baseball teams today have a home winning percentage that hovers around 55%. But with Union Park gone, baseball would continue on in Baltimore, of course, but the memories of the old ballpark would remain in the ensuing years. And with that, I'll wrap it up. I would like to thank my research sources, James Brady, Peter Morris, Bert Solomson, but in particular, the Baltimore Sun beat reporters of the 1890s, who without them, we probably wouldn't know a lot of these details. So. Thank you.
Question?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, I've always wondered about this. You had a picture of the 1896 Orioles. Is that a chicken or a dog in the picture?
Let's see, which one is it?
That
one?
Chicken or a dog?
Chicken.
You know, I never noticed that.
Is there a dog?
Yeah.
It's like a V.
No, you see the hair. Yeah, that's got to be a dog.
It's a dog.
You mentioned with Murphy and all the various forms of grading he did across the field. Is there anything you come across on just how they accounted for drainage and, you know, water movement when you got all those different grades and it's, you know, cooling is going to be an issue probably.
I saw nothing about that. It's a great question because, you know, all the literature talks about the infamous right field sort of swamp,
right,
that actually had a name for it. And it talked about the sort of the pool of ooze that drained out of the fence. But I don't know how he dealt with that. And that's a great, I'm sure Peter Morris had dug that up somewhere, but I didn't see anything in his book about it.
What were the foul line dimensions of the park? Like you mentioned center field, but not.
I don't know. Some of those details like change across sources. I couldn't really get a handle on like the actual dimensions. Although it's probably on this was the original map. I don't actually know. I never studied to see if it actually. What's that?
That's the 1901 map.
This is the 1901 map.
I think so.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So the answer is not really sure.
You had the numbers, the breakdown on the final slide there for the grounds advantage. Do you have anything that you did for the splits on the pre and post 1894 Thomas Murphy groundskeeping changes?
Yeah, no, that would be a great look. The transition from not, you know, without Murphy to Murphy. No, I don't have that. Yeah, but good to know for the future. Yeah.
You mentioned like this attempt to. Do you know how far along that got?
Yeah, I mean with Cap Anson and company.
Yeah, yeah.
It seemed I don't know I don't actually know how far it got. I mean, there's a lot of chatter about it in that like maybe 3-4 month stretch, and I had never heard that before, and so I've sort of reading about it in the sources, which was sort of a surprise to me. Don't know how far it got.
I'll throw the stupid question out there, then people can feel more. So where
Where is the park in relation to here? You said it turned into housing now. Like what neighborhood or where would it have been?
It's essentially is it Northwest Baltimore?
Yeah.
It's Greenmount Avenue. So like if
Waverly.
You, yeah, Waverly is what they call it. Yeah, there's a brewery up there.
Peabody Heights.
That's right, Peabody Heights.
That's where we're about.
That's the site of American League Park?
American League Park was at McDonald's, which is 2 blocks down.
Yeah.
We went on the tour this week.
Yeah, I couldn't get there.
Yeah, I must have.
Okay, thank you.
All right, well, anything else?
No, thanks.
Thanks all.
Very good.
Appreciate it.